No, the answer, just by the way, is that the Secretary of State's decision was way before that.
Okay, right. Good afternoon again, ladies and gentlemen. If we could resume quickly, we'd be grateful. Thanks for coming back so promptly. It's now 2:50, and so we're resuming the agenda for this issue-specific hearing on air quality, noise and other environmental issues. And before the break, we said that Mr. Humphreys was going to start the afternoon's proceedings with a note or a discussion following on from Friends of the Earth contribution, and then we will go through the other interested parties who wish to speak about this. Oh, yes. But before we go on to that, we have had a request from some of the interested parties who are here only for items 6, 1, 6, 2, 6, 3, and have to leave for personal reasons, and they won't be able to stay very late. And so we were suggesting that once we've finished item 4... we move on to 6 and do those 3 items in relation to the noise barriers and then return to agenda item 5 after those 3 noise articles, noise issues, unless anybody else has any concerns about that. Otherwise, we will stick to the agenda and get as far as we can. And we're proposing to have a short break at 5 o'clock and then work through till 6:30, by which time we will see how we're doing. Thank you. Mr. Humphrey.
Madam, all I was going to say for my part, I'm completely happy with that. Very sensible that people that can get away can do that. Could I make a sort of similar plea? Dr. Gervin, who you heard from right at the beginning, but who needs to come back for, I think, 2 relatively short items under Agenda 9 also has constraints, and if maybe when we're taking things slightly out of order for the residents in relation to Seabrook Road, if we could deal with those two items as well, and I think they probably will be dealt with fairly shortly, I think we'd be grateful as well.
I wonder, Mr. Humphreys, whether it in a sense might be easiest if we dealt with those out of order items immediately.
I'd be
then
perfectly
we
happy with
certainly
that.
Won't have people sort of wanting to come in and say, well, it's getting perilously close to the
no,
time.
I completely endorse that. I mean, I realise that people have lots of different constraints, and it's important that we accommodate them.
Right. So, on that basis, we're going to move on
to
6.1 to 6.3 first, and then the habitat regs assessment, 2 questions, 9, and then we would go back to the remaining air quality issues, and we apologise for those that wish to speak about air quality.
Forgive me, I think the intention was for air quality to be dealt with so that the Seabrook Road and East Greenwich Residents Association will be able to leave for the school run. So it's the items that are of importance to them, which would be air, noise, and the Seabrook Road issues.
Well, the only reason that I made the suggestion of immediately dealing with the noise barriers is that I could quite foresee the air quality matter extending some time, as we've got about 5 people wanting to speak, and Mr. Humphreys needing, obviously, to make some response. And therefore, I wondered whether you might have to leave for a school run before we actually reach the noise barriers at all.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay. I think we're going to deal with 6 first before we revert back to the air quality.
6 and then 9
yeah.
And then air quality, yes. Yeah. Okay. So we're doing 6.1 to 6.3. And then 9, and then reverting back to air quality. Yeah, 9 is habitat regs assessment for for the TFL team that have to leave. So we apologise for this reshuffle, but we'll endeavour to get through as much as we can. Thank you. So if we can move on then to agenda items 6.1 to 6.3, which are in relation to noise and vibration, And the first question is to the applicant regarding the proposed noise barriers at Seabert Road. And we're asking if the applicant could explain why it's not proposing to extend the barriers from Invicta Road westwards to provide mitigation for Invicta School and other receptors in that area. Mr. Humphreys, thank you.
Madam, Michael Humphreys. On my left now I've got Rupert Thornley-Taylor, who I believe you have briefly heard from yesterday. And he's a noise specialist, and he can explain the position in relation to Seabert Road.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Thank
you. Rupert Thornley-Taylor. The Seabert Road noise barriers don't arise from the result of the environmental assessment. The environmental statement did not identify a need for noise mitigation at Seabert Road as a result of the scheme. This has arisen in discussions between TfL and Royal Borough of Greenwich, who were concerned about noise impacts along the A102. And as an environmental enhancement, TfL offered, subject to the DCO being granted by the Secretary of State and subject to feasibility checks and consultation and necessary consents, to provide the barriers. So it's a matter that's associated with this scheme but is not necessitated by it, if I could put it that way. Then it follows from that that as TfL is responding to concerns raised by Greenwich, the matter of Invicta School was not part of their suggestion for noise barriers, and therefore it hasn't been previously taken into account. The location of the acoustic barrier is outside the order limits, and the securing of it would not be through the DCO, but through a legal agreement between TfL and Royal Borough of Greenwich. There are continuing studies on the engineering detail of the barriers, there was a note provided at deadline 2.
Thank you, Mr. Thornley-Taylor.
Can I just pursue this the way it might be secured? I mean, it has been put forward as something that would be proceeded with if the development consent order is made. That, to me, implies a connection between the two, even if the ES didn't immediately identify it. And surely it would be possible to have a negative worded Grampian requirement that said that prior to the commencement of construction or prior to the commencement of operation, such measures as may be agreed with the Royal Borough of Greenwich shall be undertaken, or something along those lines.
Yes, sir. I think the slight concern on this is that the Seabert Road barrier actually has nothing to do with the Silvertown tunnel scheme at all. There are existing concerns,
well,
I believe,
well,
Ms. Chambers, in
the
location.
Can you explain why then it was said that it would be done if the development consent order is made?
I think that was related to the fact that TfL would then be doing a lot of work in the corridor. There would be contractors in those circumstances. They would agree to do that work. We can uncouple it if that's preferred. And indeed, in a sense, it's quite important that you don't take it into account because it is not required or necessary in order to grant consent for the scheme. I think as part of the sort of general negotiations that we're having with the boroughs, including the Royal Borough of Greenwich, TfL has, you know, agreed to do some other works not required by the effects of the scheme, as, you know, what we said here are in effect local enhancements. But it's quite important that we don't get that confused with mitigation for the scheme. Now, as I've said, we're more than happy to do this, and we thought that we would do it through a Section 106 agreement, because there will need to be one in any event, and that would be part of it. But I don't think, you know, certainly looking at the assessment, we say it's not justified on that. I don't think, in fairness to them, Royal Borough of Greenwich say on those figures that it is justified by the figures. But TfL, you know, has said it would do these because they were asked for. Originally, Royal Borough of Greenwich hadn't asked, as I understand it, for it to be extended to the Invicta School, and that's why it wasn't shown as going to the Invicta School.
What's been said? Into the same development and consent obligation that has already been referred to about other matters, it's in a sense it would be the same as a ground payment condition, because it would be being bound into an obligation that would be presented before us and the Secretary of State.
Yes, sir. I'm for reasons I'll discuss later in relation to another agenda item, I'm not too keen on the concept of Grampian conditions in the order. The reason for that, it arises later, but this is an order that also, of course, includes the compulsory purchase of land. And to make the compulsory acquisition of land contingent upon some other event, I think we would need to think fairly carefully about that. I mean, it may be that the solution to this is simply to decouple it from the Section 106 agreement altogether. And
that might be a solution that didn't find a lot of favour around the room. But leaving that aside, if you're saying that this one could be solved by a Section 106, we'll obviously hear what your solution is about the health and safety executive concerns and hazardous substances,
yes,
which is where Grampian conditions have been suggested.
Exactly. I think I don't really see this as a Grampian condition in the sense, as I understand it in the drafting. I don't think it is being proposed that we cannot undertake the development unless the Seabert Road noise barriers are put in place. That would be a classic Grampian condition, which is what I'm saying I have, you know, misgivings about. I don't put it much beyond that.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. That's covered 6.1 and 6.2, as I can see. So can we ask... 6.3 is what is the Royal Borough of Greenwich and the Westcombe Society's views on how the barriers at Seabert Road should be secured? So shall we start with the Westcombe?
Thank you. Oh, sorry. Marilyn Little, Westcombe Society. As I understand it, that these barriers were promised many years ago when whoever was in charge then before TfL constructed the 102. Unfortunately, they ran out of money before the end of the project, so they never got implemented. Secondly, Invicta School is now in a different position to it was when you probably looked at these diagrams. And I note the diagram does not show the school as it is now. It shows it in its old situation. The school is now much nearer to the 102 than it was, and has moved sort of westwards and northwards. So the corner, the northwest corner, is very close to the gap in the housing. So it has quite close proximity to the 102. Secondly, I'd say that when we met the consultants, your consultants, they were specifically asked whether barriers would be in place before the construction of the tunnel started, thereby perhaps protecting the residents from construction traffic that would be ongoing from then on. And we were told yes. That being the case, then I think that is definitely a key milestone in the project and should therefore be in the DCO. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols. Can I ask Greenwich if they have a comment on this? Thank you.
Thank you. Kim Smith, Greenwich. The A102 and the construction of the barriers has been something that the local authority has been discussing with TfL for a number of years. I would say that tangentially the scheme does have an effect on the level of noise there. The whole purpose of the scheme is to have free-flow conditions. In free-flow conditions, the noise levels are considerably higher than they are when the traffic is static. Conversely, when the traffic is static, air quality is poorer. So in some ways, it's a no-win situation there. The local authority, as I say, has been lobbying different parts of TfL for a number of years to get these barriers installed. And as part of Silvertown, as an additional environmental enhancement, we started having discussions with the team about whether they could be provided. Our view is, within TfL and within TfL's complex budgets, we don't particularly care which bit of TfL it comes from, but an undertaking from TfL to build them is something we're looking for. As part of this scheme, if the scheme is consented, yes, the barriers going in is ideal. If the scheme isn't consented, it leaves us going back to TfL and knocking on the door again to a different department. So in some ways, when the budget was identified within the Silvertown scheme for these barriers to be put in, linked to the scheme, the local authority was happy to take it forward in that way. At the moment, we're in a position where we have an exchange of letters with TfL, where it says, basically, if the scheme is consented, the barriers will be put into a given value, which is a little bit south of £1 million. We would prefer it if they were actually secured through the DCO, if that was possible. And it's beyond my wit, I'm afraid, but our legal representative, who will be here tomorrow, was going to discuss why they think it is possible to actually include it as a requirement for TfL. In relation to Invictus School, when we first started these discussions, the school wasn't where it is now, and that's why the location of the barriers is where it is.
Perhaps it's not a fair question, but would you consider that on the basis of the move of the school location, the school, the barrier should be extended to cover the area where the school is now located?
Ideally, if physically it can be located that far further south, yes. It's a complex piece of infrastructure. There are high embankments. There are different types of materials used to secure the embankments. TfL are currently, or next month and for the next 3 months, doing detailed investigations into the area to do the final detailed design for the works. So ideally, yes, we would like to see them extended if it's feasible to do so.
I mean, as I understand it, there isn't actually a defined scheme. The document, the material that was put to us showed an illustration of potential barriers, so that whatever wording your legal representative is going to bring tomorrow will presumably cover the extent as well as the timing of any barrier provision.
I believe so. I mean, certainly with the timing of the barrier provision, we've already discussed this with TfL, and it would be at the forefront of the build process. It would be, the detailed design is being done in the next 2 quarters with a view to being able to build if consent is made as soon as that happens, and the construction could start either towards the end of this financial year or next financial year.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Okay. Sorry, I can't read your name. Ms. Moore, thank you.
Rebecca Moore, Siebert Roads residents. I just wanted to reiterate what Marilyn and Kim have said, and also to mention that on Victor Road there is also sheltered accommodation for elderly people and three blocks of flats, as well as the school. So I would like that to be taken into consideration. And as well as the noise and the vibration to our homes from what's already going on in the Blackwall Tunnel approach, the Notre Silvertown Tunnel discovered a couple of years ago that the pollution levels on our road where these children are walking to school is 2.5 times higher than EU limits. And I would like that to be taken into consideration when you're talking about these barriers, please.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. If I could progress from that and ask a question to the applicant regarding these barriers. Whilst they are primarily noise barriers, would they be a barrier to pollutants as well, including PM2.5, PM10 or NOxes? Should we put that in the homework list, Mr.
Yes, as Professor Laxton was saying, obviously he's not at all involved with the barriers, so doesn't particularly know. So what he said to me was, it would depend what is proposed in terms of norbar. In other words, I guess how high the barriers are. Madam, I think on this that the important thing to understand, as will have, I hope, been clear, firstly, that the point about these barriers is something that has actually been talked about, as several speakers have confirmed, for years. It's not actually related to Silvertown. The second point is that TfL have made it very clear that, you know, as it is doing these works, it proposes to do this. Thirdly, TfL is proposing, is negotiating with Greenwich to do this in a Section 106 agreement, which is a perfectly secure means. The only point on which there is disagreement is that we have said, because this is not scheme-related, it's not appropriate to have it on the face of the development consent order. But it will still be in a legally enforceable agreement. And, as you've heard from several speakers, we are doing work on this and preparing preliminary designs.
I don't think we're necessarily wanting to suggest that it has to be by one mechanism or another. I think we have heard from the Royal Borough that they do not accept that it is not scheme-related, and so I think that is a matter of dispute that we'll obviously have to take into account.
Well, the Royal Borough made the point that there will be noise levels will be considerably higher. I mean, we can put that to Mr. Thornley Taylor. I mean, he's an expert in this, and he can tell you.
You've said yourself that that TfL intend to do this. Bearing in mind that TfL intend to do this, it seems to me that we can spend perhaps more time on this than we really need to.
I don't disagree with that as a general proposition, believe me. As I say, we are negotiating the Section 106 agreement. Sorry, I think Mr. Rowe wanted to say something.
That's David Rowe from Transport for London. I did just want to point out that we've done initial feasibility work looking at the potential for barriers, and we've done preliminary site investigations. The work that Kim Smith from Greenwich referred to is taking place over the next 3 months is quite intrusive surveys into understanding more about the structure of the highway in that part, in that these barriers at certain locations would be connected to the retaining wall there. These are quite high barriers. We're talking about 3-metre high barriers, and the topography in that area changes, as well as the land ownership. So it's not necessarily straightforward in terms of how these are constructed. So the work that we're doing over the next three months is quite important in terms of understanding how these barriers could be constructed. The barriers would also be subject to local consultation. As I say, they are 3 metres high, and they would be up against the back of residential properties. So it's obviously important to ensure that the local residents have the opportunity to view these.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Anything else? Is your Toblerone's still up. Do you have a further point?
just to say that we've recognised now that you're going to have higher heavy goods vehicles going through the tunnel, and that must surely have an effect on the noise coming up through the 102 into the Blackheath Tunnel Southern Approach or the Silvertown Southern Approach. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Presumably that will be part of the applicant's response on this point to us.
Yes, although I think much of the noise caused from higher vehicles isn't caused at a level above 3 metres. It's caused from the engines or the wheels, which are lower, but we can do
so
that.
I think it has been said that those 400 potentially additional HGVs were not factored into the many of the assessments as they had to be sort of added on.
Yes, I think Mr. Thornley Taylor can touch on that if you want.
I think
to
it would be helpful
to. Yes.
Rupert Thornley Taylor, the 400 overhead vehicles have been considered in material prepared subsequent to the environmental statement. Their effect is to increase the number of dwellings within each of the noise bands, but not to take any of the dwellings above the significance thresholds in the ES. The way noise predictions work is that it takes a very small change in noise level to extend the contours, if I can put it that way, although we don't formally use contours like airports. Rather like sea coming in on a very shallow beach. You can cover a lot of beach with hardly any rise in water level. So there is an increase in the number of dwellings in the noise bands showing an increase, but still no increase triggers either the short-term or the long-term significant criteria. That's nothing greater than 0.9 dB in the short-term and nothing greater than 2.9 in the long-term.
Thank you for that. I propose, Mr.
Madam, I was going to say you raise this under item 6.4, and we won't preempt that now. But there is an appendix to one of our first written questions on air quality, which actually touches on the effect of including these 400 overheight vehicles in terms of noise. And the picture, in broad terms, and he can come back to it later, is as Mr. Thornley Taylor has described.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Is there anything else? No. Okay. In that case, can we move on to the matters in Agenda Item 9 on Habitat Regulations Assessment, and then go back to where we were before our break to finish off air quality. Thank you. I don't know if the applicant wants to do some musical chairs. So, in Agenda Item 9 on Habitat Regs Assessments, the panel's got two questions, and the first one is whether Natural England and the applicant could now provide an update on whether there's agreement regarding the impacts upon the recommended marine conservation zone in relation to contaminants, lagoon worms, sea slugs, seahorses and migrating smelt. So, Mr. Humphreys.
Madam Michael Humphreys, thank you very much. On my immediate left now I've got Natalie Frost, and beyond Natalie Frost, yes, I've got Dr. Gervin. Again, I think Ms. Frost is going to lead off on this particular answer.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Natalie Frost. Firstly, I'd like to say that we're still having ongoing discussions with Natural England, but just for a point of clarity with specific reference to this particular item, I thought it was worth raising that perhaps it would be better addressed in marine ecology, because marine conservation zones don't fall within the remit of a habitats regulations assessment. And similarly, some of the features that are listed as relevant to the marine conservation zone or the recommended marine conservation zone aren't actually features within the marine conservation zone, if you look at sort of the recommendations. But that aside, we have taken full account of potential water quality and sediment quality impacts on all marine ecology features, so benthic habitats and species, fish, marine mammals, and as part of that assessment, looked to see what the potential impacts would be on all of those features and have concluded that there would be no adverse effects on those features as a result of changes in water quality.
Thank you. Have you got agreement with any on that yet?
Discussions with Natural England are still ongoing. We've got a further meeting with them later this month to clarify that point.
Thank you very much. And then the other point in agenda item 9 is further to NE's response to one of our questions. Is there agreement between the applicant and NE regarding the use of the two local authority, local plan, HRA screening assessments and their omission of the in-combination effects arising from the proposed development in them? I think that was purely a timing matter, as I understand it. And is further HRA screening required? Thank you.
Madam, I think as has been made clear, no further HRA screening is required by the applicant on this for the reasons that were just described. It was agreed on the 9th of January in a revised version of the Statement of Common Ground between ourselves and Natural England that the TFL response provided in our comments to the to your first written questions, that's REP 2-034 for HRA 2 is acceptable, and I think that updated Statement of Common Ground will be coming out at deadline 3.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys, that's fine. Does anybody else have any comments on this matter before we go back? That's very kind, thank you. Okay, in that case, can we go back to where we were before we adjourned? Back to agenda item 4, and it was the last item in 4, which is 4.13. We'd heard from Friends of the Earth, and there were, I think, 3 more interested parties to my right, and then one in the audience, Mr. Opick. So if we can carry on going towards you in that direction, and we'll get to you hopefully not in the near future. Thank you. So the next Toblerone up is the Westcombe Society.
This follows directly on from the point made by my colleague yesterday on traffic diverting, rerouting through the local area network. This is rerouting both towards the Blackwall Tunnel, Silvertown Tunnel to avoid queues elsewhere, and away from the Blackwall Tunnel, Silvertown to avoid the charges. now, the extent of this rerouting of traffic must be particularly subject to errors, to bigger forecast errors than most things. It's very difficult to forecast. And therefore, we've got to make allowance for a very wide range of possibilities, of possible outcomes. And, of course, the issues of congestion lead straight on, and traffic leads straight on to air quality as a result of traffic. The immediate point is that, therefore, there's a need for a much more widespread location of pollution verification points. Currently, there are a couple just west of the just west of the A102 on Trafalgar Road. There need to be a lot more. There need to be identification points further west along this road, in East Greenwich, in the centre of Greenwich, maybe Blackheath Hill, Kibrook Interchange, etc. There are a wide range of possible points where, because of the uncertainty and not knowing how much traffic will be rerouting and what routes it will be taken, is uncertainty over all of that, there need to be a widespread of pollution verification points. And of course, by the nature of things, it will turn out that in most of these cases, nothing great will happen. But in some of them, there may be very large impacts, and we don't know which ones they will be. Now, so first point then is the need for more verification points, pollution verification points. Secondly, then, there is the need to consider possible mitigation. Now, for traffic, for the level of traffic and therefore resulting air quality issues for traffic going through the Blackwell and Silvertown tunnels, one can use charging as a mitigation measure. This is not going to work particularly well for traffic rerouting either towards or away from these tunnels. And therefore, there is a need to consider other possible mitigation measures. What have TfL in mind? One possibility, which has much wider implication, would be something like widespread distance-based road user pricing. But people seem to be shying away from that. But maybe there are other ideas. So it's two points. We need more verification points, and then we need some idea of how subsequent problems can be mitigated. Thank you.
Thank you for that. So it's no to Silvertowns. Thank you.
Thank you. Arne Robbins for Nota Silvertown Tunnel. Just broadly and quite quickly to say, we find ourselves in agreement with local authorities that if traffic impacts are worth monitoring and if traffic mitigation may decouple from air quality deterioration because of changes in types of vehicles, then air quality monitoring should be improved throughout this area with triggers for mitigation. In particular, sensitive receptors should be mapped, something TfL seem to have not done. We see that mapping of sensitive receptors for noise impacts shows three schools within 200 meters of the northern portal. And we support the Friends of the Earth statement that beneficial impacts should not be used to offset deterioration elsewhere, especially if it's redistribution of effects. Thank you.
Thank you. So if we work our way around the table, we have a... Yeah, okay, over there. Thank you. Could you explain who you are and which...
Hello, madam. Charlotte Baker, East Greenwich Residents Association. And I may have misunderstood, but I just really want to clarify a point. And also my question is to the host boroughs, specifically Tower Hamlets and to Greenwich. After the break, we came back. Transport for London dismissed point 4.2, Enderby Wharf, on the basis of an old planning application, because they could, they did. I'm interested to know, Greenwich was talking at length about their concerns about the lack of air quality assessment for traffic. Are they happy with the dismissal of the air quality monitoring for the Riverside? I.e., are they happy that Transport for London has used out-of-date information to make a rather expedient decision? EGRA has taken... we have a judicial review about the cruise liner terminal, And it was on the basis of emissions that we were granted a judicial review. We lost it, but we were at appeal. And our contention is that cruise ships can burn 700 litres of diesel an hour, equivalent to 688 HGV lorries. Now, that's our supposition. But can you really dismiss Enderby Wharf on the basis of a planning application that was granted before the plans changed for the cruise terminal? You're using old information because you can. But actually, we've been granted judicial review on the basis that air quality is a huge issue, and we're at appeal because it's a huge issue. So I'm interested to know whether the Royal Boroughs of Greenwich and Tower Hamlets, whose MPs have both spoken to the Select Committee about the air pollution that will be caused by the cruise terminal, have a view, and how Transport for London can explain using out-of-date data. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a date for your appeal?
I don't think we do. No.
Thank you.
Could I just clarify, is it that you are seeking the leave to appeal, or has that been granted?
I believe we're still seeking the leave to appeal.
I propose to complete this circuit of asking OPs to complete their oral representations in relation to 413, and then maybe we can go back to Greenwich to see if there's a response right now. I know that Mr. Humphreys wanted to respond to Friends of the Earth some time ago and apologise for going past him in order to try to expedite the agenda. So the next Toblerone up, as I can see it, is on the corner over there, which is that Newham? Thank you.
Robin Whitehouse, London Avenue. I don't intend to speak for more than a few seconds, really, as I've said quite a lot. I just wanted to raise the issue of mitigation at the Hula building. It would be it seemed to be impossible for me not to raise this as an individual point. The building, which has been much quoted over the last couple of days, suffers the largest impact and moves from a position of compliance in terms of air quality objectives to non-compliance. That is true of both the original air quality modelling and the more recent air quality modelling, which actually showed it to be even slightly worse. The concern I have is that we have asked on several occasions in relation to for mitigation for this building, of which I think the first floor only is predicted to exceed. And it seems to Newham that it seems impossible that on a scheme of such a level, of such a scale, a £1 billion scheme, that the worst affected residential building is not considered suitable for mitigation, and we would question as to whether we believe obviously that the National Planning Policy Guidance would apply, in which case there is grounds for mitigation irrespective of the particular status of this scheme in terms of national infrastructure schemes.
Thank you for that.
You're making the case that there ought to be mitigation. Have you a view on how that mitigation might be achieved?
Robin Whitehouse, London Avenue. Mitigation, we've discussed the possibilities of mitigation in terms of traffic management. So obviously we have the TIMS, which has been discussed, and obviously, and we've also talked about the M4 type scheme. But in addition to that, it would be we've mentioned the fact that the ultra low emission zone, for example, could be applied to. So we could sign up for that to be applied to this scheme if and when such a scheme is enacted. And additional, if all else fails in terms of traffic management, then it is possible to protect the building itself. there has been discussion, or there has been, with regard to the fact that it already has mechanical ventilation, for example. That mechanical ventilation is for noise purposes, as far as I understand, and I've not seen any evidence to suggest that mechanical ventilation is there with a view to any air quality benefits, for example, by the use of filtration or by the use of drawing in air from, say, upper floors rather than the level the building's at. So, I mean, those are possible mitigation measures that could be applied peculiarly or specifically to the Hula. In addition, one of the things that could also happen would be for that area to become a focus area, air quality focus area, as TfL and GLA produce across and several of these across London. And I mean, that is something in terms of mitigation, because that would drive through a package of mitigation, is something that could obviously occur not merely at the northern end of the portal, but also something that could happen on the Greenwich side as well.
Perhaps just a final point of clarification. The Hula building is on basically not quite a traffic island, but it's almost the equivalent of. Does the problem occur at first floor level all the way around the building, or only particularly at the higher side where the road is going up to join the high level road? Silvertown Way, isn't it? Viaduct.
It is. The view that was taken, as I understand, by TfL is we have several roads at several different levels in the area, and therefore it would be very difficult to make a very accurate assertion as to what the levels would be at any particular level, because we have elevated roads there as well. And so TfL have responsibly taken the view that they would obviously, in respect of that layout, take a worst case view. And as far as I'm aware, they have just said the whole of that floor would be exposed to those levels.
Thank you. Can we go on to Mr. Opick then, I think, who will be the last in this agenda item? Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Lambert Opick, Motorcycle Action Group. Yesterday, and I don't need to rehearse the arguments from yesterday again, you'll recall that I gave the applicant the good news that they can achieve their congestion and emissions targets more effectively by encouraging modal shift from four wheels to two, because motorcycles reduce congestion and, it seems, reduce emissions. Today, I have a bit more good news and two questions. The first question relates to what Friends of the Earth raised. It says under 4.8, and all of my points really relate to that, that the applicant would be encouraged to consider opportunities to secure improvements in local air quality. The question I have here is that literally the obligation, or does the applicant have the obligation to look at the macro consequences of various modes of transport? I don't think we need to go into that kind of more sophisticated, what's called a cradle-to-grave analysis, but if the Friends of the Earth are correct, and that there is a strategic obligation to think about the overall emissions from the construction of vehicles to their destruction, and in the case of electric cars, that would mean the emissions cost of producing the power as well, it would be useful to know that, because in subsequent consultation sessions, I may wish to return to that on the basis of what the applicant is obliged to do. The good news, which I promised, is this. Research published in January 2011 called Evaluation of Journey Time and Emissions of Power Two-Wheelers in Bus Lanes shows compelling evidence that if motorcycles are allowed into bus lanes, there is a reduction in journey times, which is one of the objectives of the scheme, and also in emissions. It's a superb piece of research by a wonderful organisation called Transport for London. My question, therefore, is, will the applicant be applying the lessons of that research and enable motorcycles to use the bus lanes? We touched on it yesterday, but it's highly relevant to the challenge in 4.8 today.
Thank you, Mr. Opick. Any comments in there? Okay.
Madam, I had time.
Sorry, Jenny Bates. Yes, okay.
Could I have a couple of tiny points just to flag up, and then I can put them in my written follow up. One was about levels. The World Health Organization have already found that nitrogen dioxide concentrations, there are health effects below the current EU legal limits, which are the same as their air quality guideline limits. So I'm just saying that, you know, although 40 is the sort of key legal limit, it's not as if anywhere under that is necessarily okay either. So, you know, eventually everything will have to come down. Just a bit of context, it's just to say that, you know, it's not, there are effects below current levels. And also on the cleaner vehicles, the electric vehicles, there is no such thing as a clean car or a clean vehicle, because they also produce non-exhaust emissions, particularly the particulates from brake and tyre wear and road surface wear. And the more we clean up our exhaust emissions, the higher proportion of the pollution is actually these non-exhaust emissions. And effectively, there is no safe limit for these particle levels. That's what the World Health Organization say. And the second point is that there are some, just to flag up, there are some very real immediate health effects, both examples from north of the river, Hackney and Tower Hamlets, a study being done by King's College London on the lung development, the lung size and lung development of children in schools in Hackney and Tower Hamlets, found that they are basically developed smaller than they would do. And that follows, that sort of reinforces a study from the States previously. And that's something that has been found and horrified some of the King's College people, who, at least one, who find that the existing black wall, a problem, and the idea of adding any problems anywhere else would be abhorrent. And also on the South Circular Ride, I think maybe in Lewisham, the young lady who died of an asthma attack, a child, and the Ella Roberta Foundation is really concerned about adding any traffic, any sort of worsening on the South Circular Road. I just wanted to flag those two points. Thanks for accepting that.
Thank you, Ms. Bates. I think that's all of the Toblerones that we had earlier. I ought to ask the applicants if they want to come back at this stage or if they want us to press on. Mr. Humphreys.
Madam, I think it would be quite useful to be able to take stock, because we're just sort of building up a longer and longer list of things, many of which were before the break, and it becomes harder and harder actually to kind of respond to things. So if we could perhaps just pick up a few of the things at this stage, I'd be grateful.
Yes, certainly, Mr. Humphreys.
And can I just start with just dealing with the Friends of the Earth points that were made before the break? And it's important to understand that these are points that Friends of the Earth and I'm sure Ms. Bates would more than happily confirm, have made many times before. That's why, in a sense, I'm able to comment on them fairly quickly, because I've commented on them before. First point I make is this. It is important to understand how extreme FOE's position is. The basic point that they are making is that if a project worsens air quality at a receptor which is above the 40 micrograms per meter cubed threshold, then permission for that scheme must, they would say, be refused. And this is based on their interpretation of the EU Air Quality Directive. Now, the important point is that
FOE say this, no matter how small the additional exceedance is. So, for example, Ms. Bates made this exact same point at an inquiry at London City Airport, where the exceedance was so small that the background levels would have removed that exceedance within, I think it was, 3 weeks. And still, of course, she told the inspector that permission must be refused because that was a technical exceedance. Now, it needs to be recognised that the Secretary of State, in considering these things, including at London City Airport, has not acceded to this position. Indeed, the people that might be very concerned about this position around the table are the London boroughs. Because many of the roads in London are currently above 40 micrograms per metre cubed, the logical conclusion from this position is that no development can take place in London. Because if you permitted a residential development or an employment development, some of those new people, either workers or residents, might drive a car. And if they drove that car on a road that was in exceedance of 40 micrograms per metre cubed, you would be exacerbating an existing exceedance. Now, that clearly, as I say, is a very extreme position. The position, as well, is fairly uncompromising, even in this respect. The current scheme does create some additional exceedances, but it also reduces far more exceedances. When you look at the figures, the net position is that air quality will be improved by the scheme. Now, that's like taking yourself at this point and you say, look, I have two futures. A future over here with no Silvertown Tunnel in which a larger number of people will suffer high levels of air quality, or a future over here with the tunnel where a lesser number will exceed that. As Jenny Bates has made very clear, and she's always absolutely clear and fair about this, she doesn't hide the position, Friends of the Earth position is you should refuse consent. In other words, you should opt for the position where more people experience higher levels of air quality because you're not allowed to have a single person with an exceedance. Now, if that wasn't the case, then you do come to our position. What we do, you will have seen it in our assessment, we look, by reference to the interim advice notes, the Highways England notes, at the balance between benefits and impacts. And because in this particular case the benefits are greater than the impacts, one is able to conclude, and I'll refer to the IAN later, that overall the scheme is beneficial and therefore does not have a significant impact. But the FOE position doesn't accept that, unless Ms. Bates is going to disabuse me, and I'd be delighted to hear it. Now, is that interpretation a correct interpretation of the EU directive? And the answer is no. The EU directive does require compliance with limit values, which are found in one of the annexes. But where there are exceedances, the EU directive makes it very clear what is to happen. That's in Article 23. What is to happen is the member state is to produce an air quality plan. The EU directive does not say in Article 23 that the member state is to refuse all development consent applications, and neither did Client Earth 2 say that. Client Earth 2 was about the government's air quality plan. Therefore, in the quotation that you were given, that the government should choose a route that achieves compliance as quickly as possible, which was paragraph 52 from the judgment. That was in a section that started at section 42, paragraph 42, which was dealing with the proper construction of Article 23. In other words, the proper construction of the article that relates to air quality plans. And in that context, it was saying, when coming up with your air quality plan, you should choose a route which achieves compliance as quickly as possible. So what Client Earth 2 has forced DEFRA to do is produce an air quality plan that achieves compliance as quickly as possible, and it's clear from that, more quickly than its last plan. Now, the corollary of that is that one would expect background levels to be lower than were assumed in the ES, because if government does as the High Court told it to do in Client Earth 2, it should have a more ambitious air quality plan that should therefore reduce background levels lower than those in our assessment. And so that was what I was hope was made clear. It's one of the points made clear in our Rule 17 letter. Now, the next point, third point, reference was made to the point about delaying compliance in an agglomeration. That's the language that's used in the EU directive, and how Richard Decani had not agreed with this. First point is, this was in the context of the Airport Commission and other their particular report, but you will see from the NPS for national networks, paragraph 513, the guidance, which you obviously have to take into account from government, that does refer to delaying compliance with an agglomeration. Mr. Decani's point was not that the government should not, and not that anyone should not look at that, but that it was also appropriate to look at the guidance in Interim Advice Note 175/13, and you'll see in that at Annex A, there's a flowchart. It's on page 17, and you can work through the flowchart, and that was the particular point that Mr. Decani was making, that it's appropriate also not just to look at compliance, but to look at various other things. I won't elaborate on that. But the compliance risk flowchart balances, again, increases against decreases to look at an overall picture. Fourth point, the Client Earth 2 criticisms of the PCM model. TfL obviously can and has undertaken its air quality assessment against air quality objectives. But, as we stated in the Rule 17 letter, we can't update our client's a compliance risk assessment against the EU directive until government tell us what their updated PCM modelling says about background levels for compliance purposes. But, as I've told you, if Client Earth 2 has had any effect, it is to tell DEFRA that it should achieve compliance sooner, and therefore what DEFRA, in effect, will have to do is produce a more ambitious air quality plan, and therefore the effect should be, when the new data is available, that an assessment by us, a compliance risk assessment, will show compliance earlier, because that's the whole point. That's what Client Earth were trying to achieve. The next point was, a point was made about assessment prior to scheme opening. here you need to note, of course, that the ES does contain a perfectly proper air quality assessment. The point was made, but in some way that's not appropriate because further work was going to be done and the modelling was going to be undertaken again. The first point is the ES does contain a proper assessment, but we have recognised, because the highway network is dynamic, flows will change, and therefore we have undertaken to rerun the models close to opening in order to update things, including the user charges. So that is not inappropriate in EIA terms. It is not dissimilar to what often happens for certain biodiversity interests, for example, protected species, where a developer, having carried out a proper environmental impact assessment, is then required to go back closer to construction and resurvey for, I don't know, dormice or great crested newt or whatever it is to get the latest position, and it's exactly the same. So it is therefore wrong for Friends of the Earth to suggest that just because there is any exceedance of the threshold at a receptor, that there should be refusal. The approach that we have adopted is in accordance with interim advice note, and this time it's 174/13. So the other one was 175/13. This is 174/13, tables 2.2 and 2.3, where you look at the balance, as of course there will be in a complex scheme like this, with some improvements and some deteriorations. You look at an overall balance, you look at it against the banding, and you come out with the assessment. And the assessment here, in accordance with the guidance, is that the air quality impacts are not significant. So that, I'm sorry to take a little bit of time with it, and we can expand on that if we need to when we've seen Friends of the Earth's written material on this. But I think it is important to try and give you some sort of context that this isn't some sort of binary thing. If you're over a threshold that in some way the High Court has told you you have to refuse, that's clearly not the case. Now, that brings us to various of the other points. As I indicated before, I'll try not to take up all of those, but there were points about what were called sometimes verification points, or perhaps we might call them monitoring points, things of that sort, and where they were, and also then other forms of mitigation. Maybe I can get Mr. Pyatt to just comment on things like monitoring locations and things like that, and where they are and where they could be.
That's possible, unless it would be better suited to something sent to us in writing at deadline
Madam,
3.
Madam, we'd be very happy, I think, to do that, and I know the programme is
I think that
pressed.
Would suit us better,
as
thank you.
As long as we're allowed to do that, then
yes,
I'd be very
happy. Yes, of course, that would be very, very helpful. Thank you.
Madam, I'm happy to deal with it in that way.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys.
Could
and
hold
on a minute,
please.
Sorry, can I remind you to turn your mic on when you speak?
Sorry, sorry. Would it be by the 27th of January? By the deadline?
Deadline 3, that's a fair
deadline 3.
Question.
Yeah. Madam, yes, I would I would think we could do it by then.
And thank you. And I know Friends of the Earth, Toblerone's back up. But, this isn't a public inquiry, so we realise there will be differences in opinion, and it's primarily a written process. So we'd be grateful if we could have matters in writing for deadline 3.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Go
to
forward.
Respond to Mr. Humphreys, I should address those points in my written summary, should I?
Yes, yes, please. Yes, you're very, very welcome to do so, as well as the points that you put forward. Thank you. Thank you very much in that case. Can we then move on? Right. Gotten where we are now. It's, item 5, yes. We are now on geology, soils and contaminated land. So apologies to everybody who has been waiting so patiently for this. It's not a very long agenda item. and it relates to the draft statements of common ground between the applicant and the Environment Agency regarding matters in relation to geology, soils and contaminated land that are still under discussion. We're asking the applicant, no, we're asking the Environment Agency, firstly, to provide an update regarding whether these matters have been agreed. So I understand we have people from the Environment Agency. Could we have a volunteer to give us a response? Thank you very much. If we could have your name. Thank you.
Madam, I'm Carol Bell for the Environment Agency, and I've got good news for you on this one in that the applicants will obviously indicate if they agree, but as far as we're concerned, we think we're now in agreement in principle on these issues, and it's just a case of sorting out wordings of appropriate requirements or protective provisions, sorting out the means of actually securing those issues, but we're not in dispute on the principle. And also, we've received our draft groundwater monitoring strategy from the applicants, although I don't believe that's before the panel at the moment. We've put some comments to them on that. That's as far as we're concerned, that we're well advanced on that now.
Thank you for that update. On the basis that we've got quite a positive response from the Environment Agency, does the applicant want to add anything to that?
Madam, I think Ms. Belter's put it extremely well. We're very well advanced. We think, we're talking about wording now, but I think the principles are well understood.
Thank you.
When would you expect that this draft might come in front of us and the means of securing?
I would need to just check with someone, because obviously, as you appreciate, I'm not involved in the drafting.
Elizabeth Jinks, Transport for London. We've actually submitted the groundwater monitoring strategy. It's within Appendix F of the COCP that was submitted at deadline 2.
Yes, but that is not the agreed document, because the Environment Agency said they raised some points back with you.
We incorporated their comments in that version.
Right, I see.
So will we be getting the updated version?
Yeah, we've got the updated version. It's part of the
thank you. In that case, can we move?
But the issue of how to secure this is this being suggested in the sense that it's secured by the means of securing the Code of Construction Practice?
So I believe that is the case. As I say, I think also protective provisions are being discussed. Maybe that you get some things earlier than others, and indeed some it looks as though you've got already.
Mr. Owen.
Madam, thank you. Robbie Owen, Transport for London. Just on the protective provisions, it is important to take those into account as well as the COCP mechanism, and I think in terms of timing, as you'll be aware, the draft DCO does already include some proposed protective provisions for the benefit of the Environment Agency that would be relevant in this respect. We are still discussing the wording of those with the agency. We had from the agency last week their proposed changes to those provisions. Now, I think it's going to be not until deadline 4, I would hope, for us with a fair wind to have agreed those. I think deadline 3 will be too soon. But certainly the concept of the protective provisions as being a mechanism to secure these matters is well understood and agreed. It's just a question of the final wording of those protective provisions being agreed with the agency.
Thank you very much.
We'll presumably discuss that tomorrow as well. Thank you. If that's that finished, we can move on. If we can go back to agenda item 6, we've done 6.1, 6.2, 6.3. We touched on 6.4. I'm not convinced that we totally completed it. So could I ask the applicant whether the additional 400 overheight vehicles that were travelling northbound in the air quality assessment have been considered in the noise assessments? Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, madam. We'll come to that. Just as we're now starting topic 6 proper, I think Mr. Thornley Taylor would appreciate the opportunity very briefly just to give you, I think, what is five sort of key high-level messages about the noise assessment in this case. I don't think it will take very long at all, but I think it is quite important for everyone that we just sort of set some sort of context for the discussion. Would you be happy for him to do that? It'll only take a few moments.
I'm happy for you to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we'll go straight into 6.4.
Thank you. Mr. Thornley Taylor.
Thank you. Rupert Thornley Taylor. The most important thing is that this project has unusually low noise and vibration effects, and somewhat unusually for a major infrastructure project, there are no significant adverse effects due to noise and vibration identified. And the ES does identify a number of dwellings with a moderate adverse significant effect, but they're all in one location, they're all in the Hula development. And we've therefore looked very closely at what will actually happen at that development, which has been constructed subject to planning conditions appropriate for a residential development on a site surrounded by sources of traffic noise of some considerable magnitude. And the planning conditions have resulted in a very high-quality design with facades of high-sound insulation. And the analysis which we have done has concluded that the quality of the internal noise environment with or without the Silvertown Tunnel scheme is very good. So although on the basis of external noise levels, the ES finds a moderate adverse significant effect for a small number of dwellings, those are those dwellings, and in fact, when looked at more closely, there is not an effect on the living spaces of the buildings. And even if one takes into account the inevitable uncertainty associated with modelling, that those conclusions remain the same. There is uncertainty also associated with background noise measurements, not least because when 2021 comes along, 2023 comes along, developments on the land will be different from the current situation, so not all the noise sources will be the same. But it's important that the role of baseline monitoring in the assessment process is actually quite limited. Measured baseline data are not used in the operational noise assessment, so uncertainty in background noise monitoring does not have an effect on the uncertainty of the operational noise assessment, because that just compares modelled future noise levels with and against the due minimum opening year. It's modelled compared with modelled and doesn't rely on measured background. Measured background noise levels do play a role in the assessment of construction noise in that they determine the noise assessment thresholds in the ES process, but the actual mitigation of construction noise has little dependence on the baseline. The provisions of Section 61 of the Control of Pollution Act give local authorities the power to secure the best practicable means to reduce noise, whether or not it has been found to be significant in the ES, and the in consideration of what is practicable, the background noise level, while a material consideration, is not a key driver of whether a contractor is required or not to use a different method of working, whatever practicability means in a particular circumstance. As far as the modelling of the operational noise effects is concerned, the method used is, as I mentioned briefly yesterday, is well established and prescribed in the method which the UK uses, and it takes account of a wide range of parameters, and it requires a large change in any one of those parameters to cause a material change in the model results. If you hold all parameters constant except, for example, overall traffic flow volumes, it takes a 26% increase in traffic flow to cause a 1 decibel rise in the L1018R index. And that's the smallest change in short-term noise level that gives a moderate level of significance at a receptor of very high sensitivity. And it takes a 100% increase, a doubling of traffic volume, to cause a 3 dB change. And that is the smallest change in noise level that gives a moderate level of significance at a receptor of high sensitivity. So a combination of those considerations means that the noise assessment is robust and not at risk of being materially wrong because of the possibility of some of the data turning out to be different in due course. And that, I think, sets the scene for the answers which I will give to some of the subsequent questions.
Thank you, Mr. Thornley-Taylor.
And then, Madam, you wanted us to go back, I think, to agenda item 6.4, which was the overheight vehicles, and I think before the luncheon adjournment I pointed to the draft HGV management strategy in Appendix K of the response to the air quality first written questions, and again I'll just get Mr. Thornley-Taylor to talk to that a little bit.
Thank you. Okay.
Rupert Thornley-Taylor. Yes, the Appendix K that Mr. Humphreys referred to covers the whole topic of 400 overheight vehicles. I gave a specific response earlier about the effect of those vehicles with regard to the A102 and Siebert Road. That report covers the wider implications across the scheme. As I was explaining, the effect of adding some more overheight vehicles into the calculation changes the numbers slightly. We can see in that appendix, page 1086, which gives a table showing the short-term assessment with the 400 overheight vehicles included, and the subsequent table, the long-term effects. For the reasons I mentioned earlier about you can increase the number of dwellings affected when the absolute level changes by quite a small amount, there is an increase in the number of receptors showing an increase of noise in both long and short terms, and a corresponding reduction in the number of receptors showing a decrease in the long and short terms. But not such as to change the assessment of the significance of impacts. And for looking at the matrix of that determines what the impacts are according to the sensitivity of the receptor and the magnitude of the change, there are no increases greater than 2.9 dB, in other words, nothing 3 or greater as far as the short term is concerned, and for very high for high sensitivity receptors, that means no moderate significant effects, and the long term there are no increases greater than 4.9, which again means for high sensitivity receptors no moderate significant effects. So the consequence is the inclusion of 400 additional or 400 overheight vehicles, 400 additional heavy vehicles, does not materially change the conclusions of the environmental statement.
Madam, can I just add, for the avoidance of doubt, if you remember that the document to which you were given the page references, you know, 1086 and 1087, as I said before, but I just remind you, if you have the PDF version on screen, that's the page you would go to. You won't find that on the document itself, because the document is a series of appendices which all have their own discrete numbering. So if you have the electronic version in PDF, you tap in at the bottom those page references, and it should take you to the two tables that were referred to. I hope that's clear. We're trying to be helpful in what is a long document.
Thank you.
As far as the report page numbers that those pages refer to, the first one is page 65 of the report, and the second one is page 66.
Can you send us in just a list of what you've just gone through there for the record?
Yes. Yeah. Would it help when we do the summary, which will go in at deadline 3, we can make sure that the references are in there?
Yes, please.
Would that be
in each summary point? Yes.
Yes, we can
short
always.
Short and sweet, just with the links would be great, or the page numbers.
We can certainly put the documents numbers in, and you know your rep to system and everything else, and the page numbers. This was sort of like trying to add something extra because we just realised it was a long document and it would make it easier for you to navigate that.
Thank you for that, Mr. Humphreys. That's great. Okay. On that basis, is there anything else from colleagues? No. Can we move on then? And I'll take any questions from interested parties who are not identified in any of these agenda items under 615, which is an open question to other IPs in respect of noise assessments, etc. So if we could move on to 6.5, the next few points relate to London Borough of Newham's concerns, and the first one is the point they raised regarding the lack of photographic and other evidence regarding the location of the noise monitoring stations. Is this resolved? Thank you. Mr. Hunt?
I think, again, Mr. Thornley-Taylor is probably best placed to help on this.
Rupert Thornley-Taylor. The photographic evidence and the engineer's handwritten observation sheets for all the short-term monitoring locations are in Appendix D of the comments on borough local impact reports, and the section 12.3.5 of that document. There is no photographic evidence for the long-term monitoring locations, but additional visual evidence of the locations has been provided to make it possible to see exactly where the microphone locations were. The value of photographic evidence for long-term monitoring results is a little bit limited, because unless you have a video logging of a 360-degree span around the microphone, it doesn't necessarily tell you what was the source of a noise event which may have affected the results. But it is, of course, helpful to understand the nature of the monitoring location, and that can now be seen from these additional their street view maps which have been provided in the appendix. There's also some more detail on noise monitoring in Newham, in Appendix A of that document. That's a technical note, explanation of baseline noise and vibration monitoring in Newham. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, while monitoring is a very important part of environmental assessment, and it is important to get an understanding of what kind of environment it is, the fact that some monitoring may be measuring noise sources in the present time that may be different or absent or replaced by something else in future years doesn't actually have major consequences for the assessment process and the mitigation process, for the reasons that I've already explained. There will be new monitoring for construction purposes, as part of the code of construction practice, there will be pre-construction surveys which will run for long periods, and they will play a bigger role than the monitoring which was done for the environmental statement, and will be done much nearer to the start of construction. That will deal with issues of noise sources that are there today and gone tomorrow or replaced tomorrow. While I fully understand and we've done our best to deal with concerns raised by Newham about the monitoring which has been done, any uncertainties associated with it don't really have major consequences with regard to the effectiveness of the mitigation process as we move, if there is consent, towards the start of the construction period.
As we have quite a few agenda items that relate to the Newham concerns, I'm minded to go through them all and then pass it over to Newham, unless Newham are desperate to respond to each point instantly. You're happy to go through them and then come back. Thank you very much. In that case, can we move on to 6.6, which is the next concern that we've identified from Newham about the increased number of lorries and buses on the approach roads that would create engine noise as a dominant noise rather than road tyre interaction. Can the applicant explain where in the ES this is considered and assessed, please?
Madam, yes, and obviously Mr. Thornley-Taylor will deal with this. I think a lot of what Mr. Thornley-Taylor is likely to say will refer to a document called the Calculation of Road Traffic Noise. I think it may have been touched upon yesterday as well. I don't believe you have this as a document. We will check. But if that is the case, it's quite bulky, but we will make sure you get a copy of it so that when you reread this at your leisure, you're able to cross-check against the document, assuming that that is what you would want.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
Thank you.
Mr. Thornley-Taylor.
Rupert Thornley-Taylor. Traffic noise has two main sources. One is mechanical noise from the power unit and the transmission system of the vehicles, and the other is the interaction between the tyres of the vehicles and the road surface. And at high speeds, tyre noise predominates. And if we were talking about a motorway, I'd be saying things like the fact if the vehicles had silent power units, you wouldn't get much quieter noise levels because tyre road interaction is so dominant. Here, speeds are much lower, of course, and in an urban situation, they range from zero while vehicles are waiting at junctions to modest speeds when they're moving between junctions, except in congested conditions. As far as the general point is concerned about the composition of the traffic volumes, this is fully taken into account by the modelling methodology, the document that Mr. Humphreys refers to, Calculation of Road Traffic Noise, CRTN for short, has a long-established equation in it for taking into account vehicle speed and percentage heavy vehicles. It's not the same as HGVs. Since some revisions in the design manual for roads and bridges to the procedure, it's a percentage of vehicles with an unladen weight over 3.5 tons. So the influence of an increased number of lorries and buses is fully taken into account in the modelling. There is, of course, the secondary point about the effect of the low noise surface, which is taken into account in the modelling. And some of Newham's concern is that the effect of low noise surfacing is, at least for the kind that we're talking about here, the thin surface, primarily to affect the level of tyre road surface interaction noise, and its effect on power unit and drivetrain noise is minimal. There are no low noise surfaces where the surface is porous, porous asphalt, which does have a sound absorption property, but we're not talking about that kind of surface here. And Newham's concern is that because speeds are so low, the power unit and powertrain noise predominates, and whatever you do to the surface, it doesn't justify making any allowance for it. That is taken into account in the source of the guidance that is applied here, which is the design manual for roads and bridges. If we were talking about speeds above 75 kilometres an hour, which we're not, we would be allowing an improvement in noise level of 3.5 dB for low noise surface. The DMRB recognises, as is the case, that by the time you've taken into account those segments of the road where the traffic speed is nearly zero because they're waiting at junctions, and those segments of the road where there is the traffic is moving at a finite speed between stopping points or when it's moving through the junctions during green phases in the lights, then there is a surface contribution, and the net benefit of low noise surface of 1 dB, which has been allowed in the environmental statement, is what is provided for in the advice of DMRB. So the answer to where in the ES is this all considered, the answer is it's considered in a higher level than the ES, because the ES follows well-established methodologies which have already considered it and takes the appropriate advice and applies it appropriately. I hope that answers the question. I'll just add that the percentage heavy vehicles, while it is increased, particularly on Tidal Basin Road as a consequence of the scheme, there's nothing out of the ordinary about it in the context of urban highway schemes, and there's no reason why one should do anything differently because of the percentage of heavy vehicles and public service vehicles on this scheme.
Thank you. Can we move on, therefore, to the next point that Newham have raised, which is 6.7 regarding their requirement for further assurances through 3D noise modelling that appropriate noise reductions can be achieved by the barriers proposed, and whether the applicant has considered barrier reflection effects, and is any further modelling proposed in relation to the effectiveness of the mitigation? Thank you.
Rupert Thornley Taylor. The model is three-dimensional. And the barrier effects that it takes into account are worst case. The CRTN method that I mentioned assumes reflective barriers and has a method for taking into account reflections off surfaces the other side of the road, which reduce the potential effect of a barrier in a completely free field. There is no further modelling one could do except that that there can be benefits from providing sound absorbent linings to barriers, but at the moment there's uncertainty about how beneficial that is. So the advice from DMRB is the best thing to do is make the worst case assumption that they are reflective barriers, which is what has been assumed. There isn't anything further to model. There's no need for further modelling because the concerns that Newham raised are addressed in the work that has been done.
Thank you. So if we can move on to 6.8. Can the applicant provide the scale plan showing the proposed locations of the high friction road surfacing that is discussed in the ES? And how would it be secured in the DCO?
Madam, I'd better touch on this. We could provide a plan showing where we anticipate high friction road surfaces may be required, but we couldn't provide a plan that was sufficiently definitive for it to be secured. The reason for that is that the high friction road surface comes out of the detailed safety audits, and obviously those have not been undertaken, or at least not completed at this stage. You're absolutely right. I mean, it is quite typical of most people's experience of roads will be very often as you approach, you know, the junction or traffic lights or give way or something, the road surface slightly changes, and that's the high friction surface. So we can certainly show you a plan of where that might be, but because the road safety audit may tell us that it needs to be somewhere else in addition, or it doesn't need to be where we've shown it, it's not something that could be secured. But it's a safety driven feature.
I think submitting a draft plan to us would be a step in the right direction, so yes, please, Mr. Humphreys, if
Thank
that
you.
Could be arranged.
Yes.
And then that would be available for the interested parties to look at.
Thank you.
6.9 then. The Newham concern about the use of low noise surfacing around the Hoola development on roads outside the order limits. How do you propose to secure the use of this low noise surfacing? And also something we've picked up. Should the wording of requirement 12.1a be changed so that low noise surfacing is secured across all roads in the DCO area rather than any low noise surfacing, which implies that you might pick and choose where it's going to happen?
Can I just get Mr. Thornley Taylor to deal first with the point about low noise surfaces and, you know, the effect of that on the noise assessment, because I assume the reason that you are seeking to achieve this, indeed the previous question on high friction surfaces, is this relationship of what areas are low noise and what areas are high friction, and to what extent this may change any part of the assessment. But I think Mr. Thornley Taylor can probably best deal with that, you know, the noise aspects of that first.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Thornley Taylor, that would be helpful.
Rupert Thornley Taylor. There are two ways in which low noise surfaces have been considered in this process. I've already explained a bit about them in my answer to the previous question. As a general assumption, it's been assumed that in the long term, low noise surfaces will be located everywhere. That's because this is modern practice in the surfacing of roads. It's not necessarily chosen because there is a specific mitigation need. It is a good assumption to make that the likely road surface in the long term will be of this kind, and from the point of view of environmental assessment, where one is required, according to the regulations, to assess the likely significant effects, it is likely that in the long term, low noise surfaces will be located everywhere. But from the point of view of specific mitigation measures, and in accordance with the noise policy statement for national networks, through which the noise policy statement for England is given specific effect, where we have noise levels above the lowest observed adverse effect level, there is a policy requirement to mitigate and minimize noise effects. And there's a specific assumption that where there are new or altered roads within the order limits, those will have low noise surfaces, and that is taken into account. The question specifically refers to the effect on the Hoola development. I need to re-emphasise the fact that even if there were not a 1 dB mitigation effect at the Hula development, it wouldn't alter the conclusion that the internal noise conditions in those dwellings will be of a good quality. A 1 dB change is small and certainly not enough to change that conclusion. The effect of high friction surfacing, as Mr. Humphreys has explained, is that its consequence would be where there is high friction surfacing, there would not be low noise surfacing. But the way noise models work is they divide road segments up into fairly short lengths, and they calculate the noise contribution of each of those segments. If there are one or two segments that are 1 dB noisier because they've got high friction surfaces, that only has a relatively small influence on the overall prediction, particularly as in the case of Hula, the location of the junctions around the tidal basin road circulatory system are such that they won't be the dominant segments that determine the output of the noise model there. If it was in due course a wrong assumption that there was low noise surfacing outside the order limits, it would have an effect on the numbers, because the long-term noise assessment is done by comparing do something in the opening year, 15 years after opening, against the do minimum in the opening year. And that would mean, as the surfaces outside the order limits in the opening year are not assumed to be low noise, if the low noise surfaces in the design year, 15 years later, did not have low noise surfaces, that would produce slightly larger change, but while it, for the reasons I've explained, increases the number of dwellings in the bands of noise increase, it doesn't take any of them above the thresholds of moderate significant effect. So it doesn't change the conclusions of the ES, even if it is wrong to assume that the presence of low noise surfaces on roads outside the order limit in the design year is not a likely scenario. I think that addresses the points which concern Newham. I hope it does. I'd be glad to elaborate if they have further concerns.
Madam, on your point about requirement 12, because the difference between the high friction surface and the low noise surface does not make a material difference to the overall conclusions of the noise assessment, and for the reasons that I've already explained, we don't know at the moment, until the full safety audit process has been completed, what areas would be required to have high friction surface. We wouldn't want a requirement that secured that all of the areas had to have low noise surface. I hope it's clear. I think it's implicit in any event that you can have one or the other. There isn't a low noise, high friction surface. And so for those reasons, we wouldn't want to see that in requirement 12.1a.
Thank you. The last point from Newham in that case is in relation to how the nighttime construction noise levels were calculated. Newham picked up a gremlin regarding why 2300 to 7 in the morning is a 12-hour period. I'd be grateful for clarification if it was a typo or if it was.
I think it's what we lawyers call a fair cop.
Well done to Newham.
It's a typo, and
thank
obviously
you.
Apologies, and we'll pick it up.
So it wasn't an arithmetic error; it was just purely a typo.
Okay,
and will you identify that in your response? Does that part of the documentation need to be amended to show that
that was actually a typo.
Well, it was the answer, I think, to the first written question that was the typo, unfortunately. And apologies if that's misled anyone. And well done to Newham; they win the prize. But apologies for that; it's a typo.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. In that case, can I ask Newham if they've got any specific comments on those, or do you wish to wait until you get the written reps in from the applicants?
Hello, Murray Wood from London Borough of Newham. Just to come back on 6.4, Mr. Thornley-Taylor referred to Table 2 at page 108.6 of Appendix K, I believe it is, of the document 8.4. It relates to the additional 400 overhight vehicles. Mr. Parr this morning gave us what appeared to be a plausible explanation as to why the observed data had been in some way corrected. But I think we'll have to closely look at those assumptions to see how sensible they are, and there may be an equally plausible set of assumptions that suggest that there is an element of overhyped vehicle suppression at the moment due to the lack of available headroom, and that perhaps HGVs over 4 metres in height might actually increase. So I think perhaps it might be more conservative to at least use the observed value and to calculate the effect on noise of the observed number of vehicles rather than the corrected number of overhyped vehicles. And, Madam, if I may request this of the applicant, I would like to see Table 2 reflecting the 552, I think, OHVs from the survey to see how the uncorrected figure would look and what that effect would have on noise. Thank you.
Madam, I think obviously we can look at that, but I think Mr. Thornley-Teller can tell you just from the increase in the number of vehicles whether or not it would have a material difference. So I'll just let him do that.
Mr. Thornley-Taylor.
Rupert Thornley-Taylor. Yes, my conclusions with regard to 400 overhyped vehicles would not be materially different if that number were quite considerably higher. It would take a very large increase to change the overall conclusions that I reported.
Would you be able to back that up with some calculations for deadline 3 or some simple assumptions for deadline 3 so that we are effectively jumping a deadline? We don't have the comments in now from Newham and then from you at deadline 4, for example.
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much. Does that partially resolve the issue?
Yes, that would be great. If perhaps Table 2 could just be shown to what Table 2 would look like with 550 HGVs rather than 400 would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any other comments on these noise points?
Yeah, Mark Partridge, the number of Newham. I just want to come back on 6.5. We welcome the introduction of photographic evidence. It does raise a question with us regarding particularly in one location near the Hoola, what actually is being monitored and the significance of this on the final impact. This is something we're looking into, and I'll provide further clarity in deadline 3, if that's okay. What it does raise, and although we appreciate the suggestion that the contractors will carry out further monitoring prior to construction commencing, however, it draws on the fact we need a stricter control within the code of construction practice for this. There were some slight amendments made in the last review. However, I don't believe these go far enough, and we'd be looking for more prescriptive monitoring requirements and triggers for sound insulation and potential rehousing should noise levels be found to be in those sort of ranges. And also, just finally on point 6.9, I'll wait for the written representations on the first part. However, regarding the order, I think Newham and perhaps Greenwich would like to see a suggested wording of all road surfaces in the DCO area are to be low noise unless a safety audit requires it to be high friction surfacing. That's all I'd say.
Thank you. Will you be bringing that to the DCO hearing tomorrow or submitting it to us for deadline 3?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. That's fine. Okay. Peter?
Just a point of information request. The low-noise surfaces are increasingly a feature of road repairs and as well as new roads. How long does the surface last and before it needs replaced again? I'm assuming that the polishing goes on and then it loses that low-noise effect, or maybe I'm wrong about that. I'm just wondering, what's the cost differential between that surfacing and more traditional surfaces?
Rupert Thorney Taylor, that there is a report on low-noise surfacing in the documents. 15 years is a typical lifespan, clearly dependent on traffic volumes. We'll supply the reference to the report that I refer to. I can't speak to cost. It's unfortunately outside my area of expertise.
This needs replaced every 15 years?
I'm straying into areas which probably further than I should go, but that's my understanding.
I think, sir, on that, I'm not sure whether Mr. Rowe can help, but if he can say it, and if he can't, then it's the sort of thing that maybe, again, we can just pick up. There'll be an answer.
David Rowe, Transport for London. So Mr. Thorney Taylor made reference to the fact that it does very much depend on the traffic mix, so our busiest roads would need replacing on a more regular cycle, and residential roads would be slightly less frequent than the 15 years. In terms of the cost differential, because it's becoming industry practice, there is practically no cost difference these days.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Is that sufficient from Newham, or were there any other points?
I believe we're at 6.10, are we now? So we're moving on to 6.11. So at this moment, no further comments.
No further points. Thank you very much. Okay. Can we move on in that case to 6.11 and possibly 6.12 at the same time, where the host boroughs have asked for various matters to be on the face of the DCO in requirements. The first one is construction working hours, and the second one is lorry routing. And we're asking for the applicant and the host boroughs to propose the wording for these for deadline 3.
We could consider that tomorrow.
We could do those tomorrow to speed things up, if there's nothing pressing now on those matters.
Entirely in your hands, and we can deal with it today or tomorrow, whichever you prefer.
Will the host boroughs be here tomorrow for the DCO hearing? Yes.
Yes, we will be, and we intend to cover this issue tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. So we can postpone those two matters
for tomorrow. What I'll just foreshadow on 212, just because it may foreshorten things. Paragraph 317, Madam, of the COCP was amended at deadline 2 to set out the expected lorry routes for the scheme, which would be finalised in the construction traffic management plan, which is approved by the planning authorities, and therefore the lorry routes can then be considered alongside construction traffic sort of in totality. So on that, we think the host authorities, the host boroughs, have control through requirement 5, but let's not debate it now. I'll mention that, and then they can consider that overnight and let us know what they think.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. And then yes, certainly.
The applicant be satisfied that the management plan will sufficiently
protect and be robust to protect local roads which are unsuitable and inappropriate from HGV traffic, both for contractors and subcontractors. In Westcombe Park we have a number of roads which run parallel or alongside the 102, and they are frequently used as rat runs to avoid the congestion. It would be appreciated if that any wording in 6.12 could reflect that.
Thank you. Mr. Humphreys, I don't know if you want to comment on that now.
Obviously, the lorry routing here can't control other HGVs that are moving around on the network, but this sort of system of having designated lorry routes for large construction projects is very widely used and well understood, and I believe it operates well. And to an extent, if drivers get it wrong, there are usually penalties for those drivers. You know, contractors will be placed under requirements to deliver on the traffic management plan, and if they don't, in some cases, drivers receive disciplinary action, or frankly, they are off the project. But that type of thing is, as I say, very well understood, and the boroughs will be very used to dealing with these types of things.
Thank you. I think we've got Newham wants to add something there.
Yes, just a point of clarification on that to provide some reassurance to the resident. We will be looking for, within the code of the Construction Transport Management Plan, clear identification to be in each vehicle associated with the Silvertown Tunnel project, so that they can be readily identified should they deviate from any routes and can be easily reported if that happens. Thank you.
Thank you. Can we therefore move on now? I don't see any further points over there. 6.13 is in relation to the operational noise mitigation measures in Requirement 12, which again we could defer to tomorrow, because we've picked up that the mitigation should be maintained and retained. So can we bring that forward to tomorrow as well?
Yes, madam. I think this was the item that I sort of tangentially referred to earlier when I said that ultimately the control is with the authorities as to what they permit, but I'm sure we could touch on it again tomorrow.
Thank you. And then 6.14 is in respect of the precast tunnel manufacturing plant, which we understand was not assessed in the ES, nor was it listed in the list of plant. Can the applicant now confirm that the precast tunnel manufacturing plant would not be sited within the order limits?
Madam, at the moment I can't confirm that it will not form part of the proposed development. We are looking very carefully at this and considering whether there would be additional environmental effects and whether we would need to, if necessary, make some form of application to you. It may be that we won't, but I would have been like to have been able to simply sort of confirm this, but I can't do that at the moment. But we do understand, obviously, that we would need to let you know pretty quickly if we're not confirming that there will be no precast tunnel manufacturing plant.
Thank you. I see the Newham Toblerone is up, so can we have a comment from Newham on this?
Obviously we do have concerns that it's not being included in night time and the impact that may have on residents. Also, not noise related, but another impact that needs to be taken into consideration is where that will take place within the site. Our concern currently is that through correspondence with TfL, we've found out that there's approximately 2.7 days of storage for excavated material. We currently don't think that is probably enough as it is, so we don't want to see any further plant impacting on that available storage space for tunnel excavation before it gets shipped away. Because obviously we need capacity there to cater for bad fog, bad weather and any moisture content issues as well. So any new plant put onto site, we wouldn't like to see impacted on that available storage space.
Thank you. Will you summarise that at deadline 3 for us?
Yeah, certainly.
Thank you. That would help us. Thank you. Okay, in that case, can I move on to 6.15, which is a question to other interested parties here today and asking whether they have any updates in relation to noise assessment and noise mitigation proposals. I don't see any name cards up or any hands raised, so I believe that's the end of item 6. We've got health, safety and security, which is a fairly short agenda item. If we propose to take that and then have a short break and the panel can review how far we've got and the proposals for trying to do as much as we can today by our deadline of 6.30. And we'll come back to you at 15 minutes after we adjourn anyway. But if we could do 7, health, safety and security next. The first question of which is in relation to Greenwich's response to our action points from the accompanied site inspection, and we're asking if Greenwich can give us an indication of when the Brentag application from 2012 to vary the hazardous substances consent would be determined. And that's a straightforward question to Greenwich, if you have an answer.
I'm afraid not. I will speak to my colleagues in planning and see if there's an update, and we'll provide that for deadline 3.
Thank you very much. Can we move on then to the second bullet point, which is in view of the likely timescale given by Greenwich for the revocation of the hazardous substances consent for the East Greenwich gas holder station as autumn 2017, which is after the close of this examination. We're asking if HSE and Greenwich could, and the applicant, could agree the draft wording for the proposed Grampian style requirement, which should the DCO be made would prohibit the use of the proposed development until such a time as the hazardous substances consents are revoked or modified, such that HSE no longer advise against it.
Can I in a sense add that the Brentag one as well, since they're both different but same issue really?
Yes, sir. This is the issue that I touched on earlier in a slightly different context, and I have, as I said this morning, some misgivings about an approach which would impose a sort of Grampian on something that is unlike a Grampian on an ordinary planning permission. This is a Grampian on something which is also, in effect, the equivalent of a compulsory purchase order. Plus, obviously, a considerable amount of public money would be invested ultimately in the project through the PPP scheme. And the concern is this, that the project goes ahead and then, for whatever reason, we know the Brentag application has been undetermined for whatever it is now, 4 years, that there is some delay and the scheme can't open. Now, we, in relation to the, if we take first of all Brentag, this is a sort of modification or re-granting of its hazardous substance consent. The particular facility, the Brentag facility, is already next to the road that carries these flows. In essence, with the Silvertown Tunnel scheme. That is not going to materially change. We don't understand, but I may have misunderstood this, and I'll certainly be completely corrected by the HSE, that they have any objection as such to this change. They've advised Greenwich of their views. Greenwich just haven't determined. But it seems to me that in that regard, an approach might be that there is some form of letter of comfort given to us to indicate that, you know, on present knowledge, there is no reason why hazardous substance consent should not be granted. Ditto with the gas holder. There is no gas in the gas holder, and Southern Gas Networks have other proposals. They're not proposing to put gas into it. However, there remains as a legacy a hazardous substance consent there. It was a Comar site, I believe. And therefore, there is no reason, as we understand it, why there is any actual safety objection here. It's just that nothing has been done to remove that consent. My slight reservations about the Grampian condition are slightly reinforced by this reason. As I'm sure you're aware, in relation to a number of recent development consent orders, there has been an issue between the relevant Secretary of State and the Crown Estate on what are called, Crown Rights articles. And basically, in a lot of the earlier development consent orders, in essence, there was something that just said, well, you can't take this land unless the Crown gives consent, which, in a sense, is not unlike the effect of a Grampian condition. The Secretary of State more recently has said, that's not acceptable. I don't want it in that form. And therefore, it's for that reason that I have, although I can see a Grampian condition has many advantages in sort of buying time to resolve this, I'm just not sure whether the Secretary of State would find it acceptable. And therefore, as I indicated this morning, it's quite often the case with further consents that are required for things like protected species, where you get a letter from English Nature saying, look, we obviously can't determine your application for the particular license because you can't make it yet, but we see no reason why this should not be granted. And what we would like to explore with the HSE is whether it would be possible to do something along those lines, and whether that would be acceptable to you before we have to get forced down the line of a Grampian condition. So I hope I haven't taken too long on that, but that was the sort of thinking we were going through.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. I mean, I can understand the point and the approach that you're coming at. Obviously, on a recent development consent order that I dealt with, it's certainly the case that the Secretary of State took safety considerations very strongly and therefore recommended against one particular aspect of the... he accepted my recommendation against that particular aspect on that ground. So I think it really will turn upon the HSE being persuaded that a letter of no impediment or something of that kind will suffice. Otherwise, we may be in some difficulty in a sense, not recommending a Grampian condition or something of that nature.
It's completely understood. I don't know if the HSE are still here. Sorry, with the myriad faces there. Sorry, someone's waving. I think outside this room recently, we have discussed, or not I haven't discussed, but some of the people from the team have discussed with HSE some of these issues, and I think they recognise the issue, but obviously they aren't in a position yet, or haven't been in a position. They may be different now, but they haven't been in a position yet to give us
a substantive response to that, and I don't know whether there's anything they could say. As I say, my understanding is that there's no objection to what Brenntag want to do, and as I say, the gas holder is empty, it has no gas.
Just before HSE come in, I assume that the applicant is aware of the latest representations from, I think it's UNI, if I've got remembered their name correctly, who want the hazardous substance consent determined in a different way from that which would simply address the concerns over this road scheme. So the Brenntag one might be a little more complicated than it might otherwise be.
Yes. I think on that I've probably said sort of as much as I can. I'd be very interested to understand if HSE are able to indicate a position sort of in principle yet, but I can understand if they're not.
Can we ask HSE for a comment? Thank you.
Katrina Yates for the HSE. The letter of comfort suggestion, as far as I'm aware, this is the first time it's been raised in that way. So we haven't had time to reflect on that and consider it. But I think it's important for me to clarify a couple of points before we go further. The first point is that the Grampian-style requirement is not, HSE doesn't want it as such. Its preference would, of course, be for the safety issues to be resolved at the sites. The Grampian-style requirement is a fallback in the event that the safety issues cannot be resolved on the sites before the examination closes. Now, the signs of this being achieved within that time frame are not promising at the moment. This morning, HSE received a letter from SGN, the operator of the gas holder, which stated that it presently had no intention to consent to a revocation of its hazardous substances consent. And that it regarded the autumn 2017 time estimate from Greenwich for a revocation under statutory powers to be overly optimistic. We only received that this morning, so we haven't been able to make copies available. So what we can't have is a situation where HSE's unchallenged safety advice at this examination has not been addressed in a way that can be secured and enforced. Now, the difficulty with the suggestion of a letter of comfort is, of course, that it's not enforceable, and it's actually not within TfL's gift or within HSE's gift to bring that about. One must always remember that the hazardous substances consent is a matter between the holder of that consent and the hazardous substances authority, which in this case is the London Borough of Greenwich. So I take on board what Mr. Humphreys has said regarding the letter of comfort, but on the face of it, I can see immediate difficulties from the HSE's perspective. So it follows that at this stage, the Grampian-style requirement is still seems to be the more likely solution from the HSE's perspective. The wording was proposed to TfL on the 6th of January. The parties had a discussion by telephone last Friday, the 13th, and it was at that point that it was indicated that TfL were reluctant to take negotiations about a Grampian-style requirement any further. As things stand, I'm not clear whether they would still be willing to negotiate over that, at least on a without prejudice basis, perhaps.
Thank you, Mrs. Yates.
Madam, thank you, and thank you to the HSE for that. I think the idea of the letter of comfort is, I think our own thinking has been evolving on this, and that may well, as has been explained, not have been something that was discussed last Friday. I
didn't really mean to indicate otherwise. As I say, our own thinking has been trying to evolve on this. I mean, I think it might be, as Ms. Yates indicates, helpful to progress sort of outside this room our drafting on a Grampian-type approach in case we need to go in that direction. Objective is to just see if we can do it in some other way, so that we don't need to do that. But I can quite understand, in the light of what the HSE have said and their communication from Southern Gas Networks and indeed others, that there may be problems with them giving the sort of letter I've indicated.
If I heard you correctly earlier, Mr. Humphreys, you said obviously there would be a potential problem that if the Grampian said you can't actually start using the scheme until the hazardous substance consent has been revoked, would your concern be in one sense avoided, but in another sense probably made more alarmed if he'd actually said you should not commence construction before it has been revoked? That wouldn't then put huge sums of money at risk for being expended without any outcome, but it potentially would delay the start of the scheme.
That obviously would have very serious consequences. I mean, I think we need to go away and think about this. As I say, I'm not sure, certainly in the case of Brenntag. There's no criticism intended at all. I just don't know why it has taken quite so long. In a sense, it doesn't matter. It just has taken that long.
Indeed, I think we're told that Brenntag do intend to be present on Friday morning. So maybe you can solve, subject to the good offices of the Royal Borough, might be able to solve Brenntag more easily than the Southern Gas Networks.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, both of these facilities exist next to the existing road and will continue to be next to the road after we've constructed our tunnel. I think we need to sort of take this away and try and think through to find a proper solution.
Mr. Humphreys, if we could stress the urgency of these matters on the basis we're coming up to deadline 3. And the end of the examination period is not far away now.
So. Believe me, madam, I'm more than aware of the urgency, but thank you for reminding me.
Thank you. Ms. Yates.
Madam, if I may, just one more point. I am informed that SGN have told the HSE that the gas holder is operational still and does hold gas at the moment, so that there may be a... I'm seeing shaking of the head over there, but that's what we've been told. So there's clearly a factual issue there to be resolved between the relevant parties.
I think we have an indication, I don't know whether, Emery, you can confirm, that Southern Gas Networks are also expected on Friday.
Yes, that's correct.
That's correct. So we might have a showdown at the OK Carol on Friday. But.
We weren't planning to attend on Friday. Is it intended to discuss this issue further, or are you just noting the fact that they seem to want to come? Right.
Peter, you might want to switch on your mic.
Sorry, and so some of the Southern Gaswork land is being taken, and Birch sites who seem to be involved with them, and also some of Brenntag's land is subject of at least temporary occupation. Perhaps it's not compulsory acquisition. But anyway, so... but nevertheless, it's for that reason that they're intending to be here rather than as such to deal with the hazardous substance consents. But, if we have them here, we will certainly be probing them.
I see. We will take that on board. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yates. I suggest that we look at 7.2 before we adjourn for a short coffee break, because it's a question to the applicant on a similar line. we note Article 46 of the draft DCO, but we're asking if the applicant can confirm whether it is proposing to allow any dangerous goods to be transported through the tunnel should the DCO be made, given the representations from City of London, London Borough of Southwark, who are keen, and London Borough of Newham, who is not keen for this to happen, as I understand it correctly. Mr. Humphreys.
Madam, I can confirm that, there are no proposals to allow dangerous goods through to be transported through the tunnel, and we intend to designate it as Category E under the Dangerous Goods and Use of Transportable Pressure Equipment Regulations 2009. We would not want that written into the DCO because TfL as the Highway Authority is the competent authority under those regulations, and you know, rather than Category E, it could in the future apply some other category designation to the tunnel, but it has absolutely no intention at the moment to do so. But it's a, you know, it's responsible for the entire network with all of the roads, and it would treat this road as not being in a sense different from other parts of the network, and would, you know, exercise its powers under the 2009 regulations accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. Do any other interested parties wish to comment on this? This is Greenwich. Thank you.
Thank you. Kim Smith, Greenwich. I'd just like to confirm that Greenwich would be absolutely opposed to any other category than E for the tunnel, not least because we're looking at joint approach roads, so the potential for dangerous goods to end up going down the wrong hole would be something we would have a very high level of concern about.
Thank you, Greenwich. Would you have a concern if it wasn't tied to the DCO?
Our preference would be, and I think we put that in our last written response, we would prefer if it was actually confirmed in the DCO through the, at least through the traffic orders.
Thank you. Does anybody else wish to comment on this matter? Can Mr. Humphreys, your red light is on. Do you wish to comment?
Sorry, I just not switched it off. I've got nothing to add. I've set out what our position is. We have no intention to carry dangerous goods through the tunnel.
Thank you, Mr. Humphreys. In that case, can we suggest that we adjourn for a short coffee break? We suggested 15 minutes.
I think probably before we do so, we ought to perhaps just check if we don't get through all the agenda tonight as to the potential issues that might arise for different parties. We've got the marine ecology, which presumably involves, I think, RMMO here and Environment Agency here. So it presumably involves potentially those and maybe even the Port of London Authority as well. And the same would apply to dredging, navigation, surface water, flood risk. Those are all a package that may or may not involve, maybe not all of them, the MMO, but they involve water, don't they? So I take it that you would ideally like to get through those three things today, if you can. The heritage and these other matters might be more readily able to be carried over if they tend to be, I wouldn't say more administrative. The heritage is wider than that, but if need be, we could carry those over to tomorrow when you're going to be present anyway, Greenwich, aren't you, sir?
Yes. So I wonder as well. I'm not suggesting you give me an answer now, but with some of the items, I look perhaps at, you know, Section 11, the surface water ones. A lot of the questions are asking for an update on positions. I do wonder if we were to frankly treat these as written questions and just write out what the
well
written
that of course
is
the option that is open to us at in a sense the end of when we do close
yes.
down today. Anything that is outstanding, you know, treat
yes.
as a prior notice of
yes.
a written question and crack
I think
it.
In a sense what I was indicating is perhaps over the adjournment if you were to think of those things that you think might be most suitable for written questions and those things where actually it would be really helpful to have the people, and maybe that's a way forward. It's just a thought.
Okay.
Thank you. In that case, can we reconvene at 25 to 6 on that clock? Thank you.